2 years ago, Kaylee Ross had a job, an apartment, and a life where things were more or less humming along smoothly. But when she got pregnant in 2014, everything changed.
I gave birth to my son, which was a cesarean birth. I was off work for quite a bit longer than I expected to be. Actually, I had postpartum depression, too. So I was having a hard time getting back to work. Even when I did return to work, it didn't go well, and I lost my job. Got behind on my rent, and I had a baby at home, and I did not have a car, so trying to find another job was difficult. All that rolled into one. I got the eviction notice, and at that point, within a month, I lost my apartment, and pretty much after that, everything changed. The last day that we was there, I had to pack everything in my car, and that was the hardest part, was trying to decide what you would need in a circumstance you don't understand. I lived with my father for 6 months, and every day, like a second job, I looked for housing. I probably contacted well over 150 companies or landlords. I used every resource possible, Craigslist, Facebook, newspapers, word of mouth, and nobody would give me a chance. Whether I had the money or didn't, they didn't care. They heard eviction, they shut the door in my face, they hung up the phone on me, and were very nasty. Me and my two children went to a shelter. I had to quit my job to do that because I could no longer drive out to Grandview and go to work. I stayed in the shelter for 2.5 months, and I worked full-time the whole time. I had a coworker. He did rental properties, and he happened to give me a phone number. And I called it, and the same day that I called, they okayed me on a property, and it was a house. It felt like it wasn't happening. I didn't believe it. Even though I had the key in my hand, I thought, well, what do I do now? I don't think it's sunk in yet. It's only been about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months we've been there. I think there's a little bit of fear in all of us. I've seen it in my kids that something could change again. After you go through something like that, it's always in your heart that this couldn't, maybe this won't last forever.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about eviction as part of an ongoing conversation about Kansas City's changing rental market, because according to national statistics anyway, when rent goes up, so does the number of evictions. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a story to tell or a perspective to add. That's 816-235-2888. I'd like to start by introducing Tara Raghuvir. She was a researcher for the book Evicted and spent time specifically looking into eviction in the Kansas City area. Hi, Tara.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
When was it that you were researching eviction in Kansas City?
I studied eviction in Kansas City in 2013 and 2014 when I was at Harvard, and I'm from Kansas City, so when I was looking to do research on housing, I decided to come back to the city and focus my research on Kansas City.
What made, I mean, other than it being your hometown, what made Kansas City an interesting place to explore this particular issue?
It's a fascinating case to study the private rental market and eviction. Kansas City, like a lot of mid-sized Midwestern cities, has a sizable rental market. There are a lot of people in the city who live in rental housing in Kansas City. It also has relatively affordable housing stock, meaning that there's a wide range of types of landlords in Kansas City, from large-scale property managers to what we might call mom-and-pop landlords, so folks who own one or two properties and rent them out as a second income stream. I also thought it was an interesting place to study because of the different county laws across state lines and between the counties, even in Kansas and in Missouri, respectively. So I did a cross-state analysis of five counties: Jackson, Play, Wyandotte, Johnson, and Platt.
So I understand that you interviewed 45 tenants and 15 landlords in Kansas City?
Yep, that's right.
Do any of the people you met stand out in your memory, like people you still think about today?
Yeah, absolutely. I heard a lot of stories like the one we just heard. And it really moved me. I mean, it was an interesting experience, of course, as someone from Kansas City to be sitting across the table from folks who live in the city I grew up in and were experiencing conditions totally different from anything I had ever experienced growing up in the same city. There were a couple tenants that really stuck out in my mind, and their stories have stuck with me to this day. An older couple named Chuck and Ivy, I used to open up the research that I presented in my senior thesis at Harvard. Chuck was 85, Ivy 83. Chuck was a veteran, both of them retired, and had only Social Security and veterans assistance coming in on a monthly basis. And their landlord had just continuously increased the price of their rent, which was already a little bit too high. It was over 50% of their monthly income to begin with. And at a certain point, it became untenable for them to stay. And again, they're 85 and 83, and they were evicted from their home and had nowhere to go, had no remaining living family, and then entered this cycle that we heard Kaylee talk about as well, where it becomes extremely hard to find housing once you've been evicted. And then that eviction remains on your record and sort of perpetuates this cycle of involuntary mobility and poverty.
So, Chuck, you said he's a veteran?
Yeah, he was a veteran and lifelong Kansas Cityan. His dad had been a baker. He enlisted, you know, when he was not of age yet, fought overseas, came back, worked his whole life, retired. And due to this kind of epidemic that we see across the country, where housing is not affordable even for people with moderate income, with his benefits alone, it became totally unsustainable for him to continue renting.
There wasn't anything veterans organizations could do for him or anything like that. I mean, I guess maybe that shouldn't be surprising, but it feels a little surprising.
Yeah, there are programs for specific populations like veterans, like folks with disabilities. And this is actually one of the interesting questions I pursued when I was looking to see what I was going to study. There are public benefits programs. There's a whole federal department obviously dedicated to housing and urban development. The fact is that only the luckiest of potential renters benefit from those programs, like Section 8, like housing vouchers, like the particular programs that benefit folks with particular identities. And then the rest of the people who need affordable housing are left to the private market and to private landlords. And that's ultimately where the most vulnerable renters in our society are concentrated these days.
The main thesis of Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted, which is the book you were doing research for in Kansas City, his thesis is kind of that eviction isn't a result of poverty, that it's more of a cause of poverty. Up until the point where you're evicted, things are basically held together. But once you lose your home, everything else really tends to go at that point. So it can be hard, if not impossible, to put it all back together. Is that what you observed here in Kansas City?
Absolutely. I think Matthew Desmond and I sort of share a conclusion. He studied Milwaukee. I studied Kansas City. That eviction is both a condition and a cause of poverty. And it's part of this cycle that traps people in a certain condition, and it can lead to really unfortunate circumstances like chronic homelessness, right? So in the past 10 years, there's been a real increase of in terms of the attention that people are paying to homelessness as an epidemic and as sort of a feature of poverty. Eviction actually causes homelessness, right? It causes involuntary mobility. It causes this cycle that traps people in pretty desperate situations.
Did you get a sense in your research that there were two sides of this argument? I mean, on the one hand, an argument for resolving non-payment of rent through some means other than eviction, and on the other, I'm guessing that would be from maybe the landlord interviews, probably, an argument for eviction, for why that's, at least in some people's view, the correct answer?
Sure. I spoke to a number of landlords, as you noted, and, you know, some of them told me stories that made their case really sympathetic in terms of why they would need to evict certain tenants because of drug use or mistreatment of the property. And even the basic argument that, you know, I've entered into a contract with this person who's renting a unit from me and they fail to uphold their end of the contract, so I need to evict them, right? Because this is about my bottom line. And I think that's what makes housing and specifically eviction such an interesting case to study, because housing is actually not just a commodity. It can't be treated like someone's bottom line because there are social implications to everything with regard to housing. Housing for one person is a business, but for another person is shelter, is a basic human need, I think a basic human right. So while I think there are arguments on both sides of this, I think the overall picture is that we have an affordability crisis as a nation, and that's no secret. It's been getting worse and worse since the 1960s when housing became the largest household expense across the country. And we have a demand for affordable housing specifically that far outpaces the supply. So that leads to a circumstance where people are going to fall behind on the rent. They're going to get into a circumstance where they can't uphold their end of the deal. And while for landlords that can be sort of impetus for an eviction, we see what that means for the community and for tenants specifically. And we need to find a solution, I think, that's something besides eviction.
Well, let's back up. How does eviction work? I mean, what are the basic steps in the process of ousting a family from a home?
Sure. So it's a really interesting question because eviction doesn't look one particular way. Desmond writes about this in his book. I follow a number of tenants who experience different types of evictions. There's the really formal process where you get a posting on your door and you get a court date. You have to show up to court. A judge hears the case and then a decision is made. Either, you know, sometimes an extension of the time that you can stay and see if you can pay the rent, or an eviction judgment, meaning that then either you move yourself out of the house or the sheriff comes and moves you out at a certain date. So that's the really formal process of eviction, something that I write about based on my experience in Kansas City and that Matthew writes about based on his experience in Milwaukee and beyond, is that to only think about evictions as formal processes that happen through the courts is a gross underrepresentation of what the dynamic actually looks like. In fact, landlords evict tenants all the time without even taking the case to court by doing things like removing doors, threatening tenants.
Wait, removing doors? You just take the door off and then someone is basically not secure in their home.
Absolutely. And you know, that was part of the really painful but fascinating stuff that I discovered in conversations with landlords is that, you know, there are these moves that they can make based on the power dynamic of a landlord-tenant relationship that can evict someone really quickly, almost without notice, totally outside of any legal process. And sometimes landlords feel the need to do that. And tenants often are less aware of their rights in that type of circumstance and, you know, go ahead and move.
In the case where it does go to court, I mean, does it ever happen that the court says to the landlord, no, you can't evict this person? Did you ever witness that?
Yeah. So I observed a little bit over 100 eviction cases in various counties in the Kansas City metro area. And what I found in the court process was really shocking to me, but perhaps not shocking to others who know landlord-tenant court. The landlord was always represented, always had a lawyer. The tenant was never represented. I never once saw in all of those over 100 cases a tenant with a lawyer present. And more than half of the cases that I witnessed, the tenant was actually not present. So in the instance when a case is heard by the court and the tenant is not present, you can almost certainly guarantee that it will result in an eviction judgment, be decided in favor of the landlord, and then the tenant will be kicked out of the housing unit. even when the tenant was there, the process was a performance. If the tenant had not paid the rent, that's a breach of the legal contract, and therefore they really have no defense in court with or without representation.
Wait, but why? So I'm curious. I have guesses, but why doesn't a tenant show up for this important decision?
There are a number of different reasons I found that might explain why a tenant wouldn't show up to court. One is that they don't know what's going on, right? The landlord has a process to follow in terms of posting a notice on the door, following up with the tenant. And sometimes that information is just not understood, right? It's a really complicated process, complicated set of laws. So that's one reason. Another reason is a tenant works, right? And if the case is in the middle of the day and they can't get off work to go to their eviction hearing, they may not go. There are a number of different reasons why a tenant wouldn't show up. Actually, one of the ones that I found was most common in my conversations with tenants was that they were just kind of resigned to the fact that, yeah, they had fallen behind on their rent. No, they weren't going to be able to make it up. And they just knew that they would have to move out of that unit. So they didn't really see the purpose in going and fighting when they didn't really have any legal defense.
I want to get back to some of this, but let's take a call from Steven. Steven's calling us from Westport. Hi, Steven.
Hi.
What can you share? Steven,
I'm evicted.
Sorry, could you start that over? We didn't catch the beginning of what you said.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So I guess I have not ever been evicted before, but I have been in a situation where I was, you know, living in a friend's basement and that sort of thing, just because I was in between housing, couldn't afford my rent or, you know, whatever. But I guess my question is more on the ethics side of eviction and really the cost of, you know, the rent housing market. Most of my friends and coworkers have a rent somewhere in the range of like $900 to $1,200 a month. And personally, I'm a white 31-year-old with a wife and daughter, and we probably have the second cheapest non-Section 8 housing rent in Kansas City. We pay $475 a month for a big two-bedroom. Just the landlord hasn't raised his rent in a dozen years. But, I mean, $475 a month, even making, you know, $36,000 a year after taxes, it's still, you know, it's a quarter of my budget. It's tight.
Yeah.
And so $900 to $1,200 a month is, especially for even a smaller place, is kind of ridiculous. And one could even put out the idea that it's unethical.
That's an interesting idea. So Tara, that kind of goes along with what you were saying, that there's an ethical, that it's a right, that affordable housing is a right. Is that an idea? I mean, that sounds like what Stephen is also arguing. Is that an idea that is gaining traction in any circles?
I think it's a really interesting question. It's an idea that seems really basic. I mean, it's on sort of hierarchies of need, that understanding that shelter is one of those is a prevailing understanding. But I think for some reason it has not grasped the public's attention in the same way that healthcare as a human right, for example, has. So I think to answer your question, in some circles, like in the academic circle and the housing justice circle, in circles of folks who work on fighting poverty, I think it's certainly there. But I don't know that it's actually broken into the public understanding of rights and, you know, things that we can all expect as human beings. And I think Stephen's point is really well taken, that even for folks who earn sort of moderate incomes, rental housing is unaffordable. And that, you know, affects all of us who rent, and it disproportionately affects the poor because the demand for affordable housing is so high.
Talk to me a little bit about the tenant's experience of eviction. I mean, the picture in my mind involves a scene of someone's worldly possessions strewn across a front lawn in sort of a humiliating display. Is that an accurate picture?
It certainly is. Like I said before, though, eviction doesn't come in one shape or size. It looks pretty differently. And sometimes, as I define eviction, eviction can also mean someone moving themselves out in more of a discreet, less of the, you know, item strewn across the lawn type of way. But if a landlord, for example, like threatens you to move and you don't want that scene of the sheriff showing up and you move your own belongings out, I believe that still constitutes eviction. So sometimes it looks that way and sometimes it looks differently, but the result is usually the same, that there's housing instability, that folks end up then sleeping on the couches of relatives or friends, and then a couple moves follow that. And right. What also follows is inability to rent again.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear how eviction affects kids' performances in school. And if this is an issue that's touched your life, please share that perspective. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking about eviction with Tara Raghuvir. She did research here in Kansas City for the book Evicted by Matthew Desmond. I want to bring another guest this morning in on the discussion. Brent Schondelmeyer is with us from Kansas City's Local Investment Commission, also known as LINC. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So you see how a family's eviction from a house or apartment affects kids through the education system. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, it seems like leaving an address might also mean leaving the school that serves that address.
In some ways, the work around eviction was really kind of an eye-opening sort of experience. If you're working in schools, and LINC provides large after-school programs in several school districts, primarily Grandview, Center, Hickman, Kansas City, and we sort of see families moving. If you engage in trying to contact and reach families and you send them mailings, the mailings come back and you wonder, well, where are these families? And then you come to understand is that the families really are in motion. The reason why they're in motion, and I think Tara gets to a portion of it all, is in some cases it's involuntary. They may have been evicted. In some senses, they actually may have voluntarily moved to a different neighborhood for considerations, a closer proximity to a job, safer neighborhood, a different housing sort of opportunity available. But one of the really unusual aspects of it all is we just don't realize is that the kids are moving. And it's not just in the summer when it's a good time to move. They're moving in September, October, and November. And one of the reasons why you know this and you have a sense of it if you're working in the schools, but a very, very important study was done in 2015. There was a mobility summit. Kansas City Area Educational Research Consortiums contacted the school districts in the Jackson, Clay, and Platt counties, and they looked at mobility really between the school districts. It is not fully appreciated. In some senses, it's not really sort of fully understood. One of the characteristics of our community, it's a very low, a very affordable housing market. A recent study said it was the second most affordable housing market in our community, but it has really small school districts. We don't have the large school districts that you would find in Chicago and other places. Our school districts can be 6,000, 9,000, 15,000. The largest ones are 25. So when a family moves to seek alternative housing or other housing arrangements, it's not unlikely that they can move from one school district to another school district.
So would having one school district in Kansas City make things in some way better for these kids?
That would be beyond the community's imagination or ability to sort of pull off. But we need to really sort of recognize there's nothing necessarily wrong with having smaller school districts, because in some ways you feel like you have some proximity really to your educators. If you're in a school district, you can know your school superintendent. If you're in a school district, you can do. The difficulty is as families are moving and moving and moving, they don't know their school. They don't know their principal. They don't know their teacher. Students don't know their fellow classmates. It's not uncommon in, say, in a class of 25 that over the course of a year, a teacher may teach 40 different sort of students. So one really important aspects of it. It's not just that they're moving and this disruption and the social connections that occur, but when you move between schools or school districts, you very well could have an entirely different school curriculum.
When you look at this, not from like the big picture as we're doing now, where you talk about what is happening to families broadly, what is happening, what are teachers experiencing broadly, but really looking at an individual student, how does mobility affect an individual student?
It affects them in really important ways. One of the aspects, it's really actually difficult to get re-enrolled in a new school. The level of documentation that you have to provide, you have to provide a utility bill, you have to provide a rental agreement, or you have to show that you own the property. Those very well may be the same reasons that, as Tara indicated, that you had to move from some prior place. We're moving into a world of modern technology, so you might be able to get your utility bill, but you have to get online to get your utility bill. And many there is a digital divide in our community. So the real challenge is that students are moving from school district to school district, and as they make this transition, it can take them 4 to 5 days to get back re-enrolled into a new school. So when you have a school year that's 175 to 180 days, they're really out of school. Most people have a view that says children are more likely to learn when they're in school rather than when they're out of school. Good things happen when they're in school. But it's just really hard as families are moving, particularly with great frequency.
Talk to me more about kids' performance in school.
One of the things that came out of the mobility study is that kids really performed on standardized tests. This is the Missouri sort of experience at significantly lower rates on really important things like communications, arts, and math. And that's not surprising. In reality, is the kids who are mobile have spent fewer days in school, and they may or may not necessarily have been fully prepared with high-stakes sort of testing. One of our school's principals sort of pleaded with our staff to sort of go talk to a large housing complex. It was okay if the move-in special occurred, but could they move it from April to May because they wanted the kids there for the standardized test in April? So there's this really sort of convergence of different dynamics sort of going on that haven't really sort of appreciated. So few people have really sort of looked at eviction and the issue of student mobility as related sort of topics. What's interesting for Kansas City is that we've had really two solid studies, one really around eviction that Tara sort of talked about, and this other sort of study of about student mobility. And it's just a ripe field for the community to sit and think about, you know, what does it mean? What can we do? What are the opportunities?
Well, yeah, and the what can we do category, I mean, with the causes of this disruption to kids' education being not educational, you know, I mean, how does an education system or people even on the periphery of that support the kids, or, you know, make sure they still get a good education? Or
you're at the crux of a very interesting and complicated, you know, issue. But I think our community has a predisposition to sort of tackle difficult things and hard things. In some ways, the value of this conversation today is people can start applying their minds and imaginations to what it is that it looks like. You can talk about eviction really as an adult problem. It's the economic relationship between one contracting party and another contracting party. But attendant to that is also what are the consequences for the young children who might be in that housing. Our community, in some senses, we live in a Lake Wobegon world where we believe that all the children are above average. When the foreclosure crisis came, we didn't believe that it happened in our community because it happened in other places where housing was more expensive. But the significance of this is that we are an affordable housing market, our rents are affordable, and yet this great degree of student mobility is occurring. One in five children moved within the school year. There are 10% that missed 12 or more days. And that's almost two weeks, almost 3 weeks of school. And so there's this notion of chronically absent kids. And what are the reasons that the kids aren't in school? Housing could be one consideration of it. It could be that they're staying home to take care of a sibling. It could be that there's health-related issues. So it's not just eviction is the cause of student mobility. Eviction is a contributing aspect of student mobility.
Tara Ravugir, I'm assuming that the repercussions of eviction for kids go beyond education. Can you give me a little bit of insight into eviction from a kid's perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great to be on air with Brent. He and I have had some really interesting conversations, and I think the student mobility research has been really critical and lent some critical insights to the work that I've done as well. You're right. Eviction is an impact on the lives of kids. And eviction also has an impact, not just in terms of mobility, but in terms of a kid's mental health, right? We heard the story at the top of the hour from Kaylee, who talked about how her kids are living in sort of perpetual fear of when the next move might come. It's that sort of potential for instability that researchers have shown is traumatic for a young person. Not to mention the sort of cycle of poverty that the family then goes through. As I said before, I think eviction has been shown to be something that is a black mark that remains on someone's record and then makes it harder and harder to find housing the more evictions you have. So that cycle, of course, affects the parents, but really deeply affects students as they lose their community with each move.
Well, I want to get back to how different kinds of communities are affected by eviction, but we have some calls who, actually, we have a few callers who have things to say about landlords, and I'd like to hear about that. Let's start with Debbie in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Debbie.
Hi there. I am actually a tenant, and I have never been evicted, but I have been kind of without a home for a couple of days. And I just wanted to say from a landlord's point of view, and I'm not discounting anything that your guests have said, but my landlord owns two properties, and he's the kind of guy that he'll work with you. But there have been so many people in his other property, which I help him look after, that don't tell him what's going on. Don't go to him when times are tough or anything. He's never gone to eviction court, whereas he could have. But he's had to bite it a lot. People disrespect the property, break it down. So it works both ways. And I'm not saying all tenants are like that. I just wanted to say that not all landlords are like that.
And Debbie, are you saying that you've gone to your landlord and sort of...
I haven't, because I'm blessed to never have done that. But my landlord, because I kind of... The other house he owns is next door to mine, and I kind of keep an eye on it because he lives away. And I can tell when people are getting ready to move because, you know, there's obvious signs. But they'll never go and see him about it or say, you know, I'm having problems paying. Can we work something out? And he would. He's that kind of guy. I've lived there for 10 years, and he's a lot of the reason.
Well, thank you, Debbie, for that insight into that maybe there are solutions that people simply don't know they could pursue. Tara, is that your perception, that there are landlords who will work things out with people?
Absolutely. And I actually worked with some organizations in Kansas City that work on sort of negotiating out of court between landlords and tenants, because I think Debbie is right. There are a lot of good landlords out there who don't want to put someone out on the street, don't even want to put someone through the process, which, as you said before, can be humiliating of, being taken to eviction court. So I think that sort of out of court resolution is possible. It's something I've seen, but it's not a comprehensive solution.
Just quickly, what are some organizations that people might be able to turn to?
Legal Aid in Kansas City is really strong. I worked with them closely to figure out some of the legal dynamics. There were a couple of other organizations. Maybe I can follow up with you with the specific names because it's been a couple years since I was in touch with them. But yeah, conflict resolution organizations locally had certainly been exposed to the issue of eviction and were actively working on the conversations with landlords and tenants outside of the court process.
Let's hear from another caller, Mark in Kansas City. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
What's your perspective on this?
Well, I'm a landlord and have been for over 12 years. Have less than 10 properties. So I've seen both sides of it. And as a landlord, I do try to work with tenants. And I hear some of your callers talking about good landlords, bad landlords. There's good tenants, there's bad tenants, there's good landlords, bad. I try to put myself on the good side of stuff. I'm diligently remodel nice properties, put people in them, and hopefully they can live there and go on with their lives and raise their families and stuff like that. But ultimately, if it's like a car, if you don't make your payments, you know, they come and take your car.
Tell me more about what it takes for you to see eviction as the only, I'm assuming the only solution. I mean, are there situations where you pursue other solutions?
I think eviction is the last resort. And at least in my view, it takes time. It takes, you know, it's labor intensive. It's costly. Sometimes you have to hire attorneys, you know, and such. And it's a process. It takes, you know, 2 to 3 months to do that. And I just, you know, if someone falls behind and they haven't been with us for very long, less than a year, you know, the first year lease, and I just say, hey, look, if it's not working out, what can we do to make things, you know, profitable for both of us? And ultimately, if you're just not going to pay your rent, well, then I really have no choice. The property has to pay for itself.
Okay.
So I ask them to, but ultimately, if they don't, then you have to go down that legal course of eviction. I've never had to truly evict someone.
Well, I'm glad that you haven't had to do that, Mark. And it does, it sounds like it's potentially a really tough choice for a landlord who does care. I mean, to get back to this question about sort of systematically, why, Tara, I mean, from your research, any theories on how it is that we have a system where the cost of housing is something that so many people can't afford?
Yeah, well, I think to address Mark's point specifically, most of the landlords I spoke to had the same thing to say, that eviction was the last resort. It is cost intensive. It is time intensive. And then, of course, there are all the social dynamics that make it a really deeply unpleasant process for both sides. But let me tell you a figure. I studied Kansas City eviction records, and specifically the records from Jackson County from 2000 to 2015. And in total, over that period, there were 156,624 evictions. That's over 150,000 evictions. And those, again, are just the legal evictions, right? Just the ones that make it to court and then through the court process. That brings us to an average daily of 27.
Yeah, that's insane.
It's a huge number. So if 27 is, you know, last resort evictions where the landlord has finally sort of decided that enough is enough, what we're seeing is that this is an epidemic, right? And I don't think Kansas City is the worst market for this in the country, but if there are 27 evictions happening per day in Kansas City, that's a problem that needs a more comprehensive solution than just kind of like filling the gaps with good landlords and sort of understanding that there will be bad tenants. Because as you said, as I said earlier, the affordability gap is not one that's going to close on its own. The supply of affordable housing is not meeting the demand for affordable housing. And that means that we're going to continue seeing this disjuncture, and it's going to disproportionately affect the poor.
Let's hear quickly from Brian in Kansas City. Brian, we don't have a lot of time, but I'd like to hear your perspective on this.
I don't need a lot of time. I'm Brian Buchner. I own Rycor Realty. I have 34 years of specializing in what I call the older housing stock, which is turned into the inner city and as net by name. As far as applications, if someone has just been through an eviction, the analysis as far as not just point-blank turning them down, but actually accepting them because they've been there and done that, and they don't want to go through it again. And I have a large success rate and a large following of people that appreciate me. Sometimes you charge 2 months rent security deposit, equivalents of 2 months rent, which is the maximum allowed by Missouri law. I am talking Kansas City, Missouri. The other thing is we had a mortgage crisis. Lenders would do workouts with the borrowers.
The other thing is
when people were evicted because of predatory loans, I didn't even count that against it.
So it sounds like, this is just a really complicated picture for landlords, but we'll get back to that. We're going to resume our conversation about eviction in Kansas City when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman.
I've noticed once you have an eviction, it's like being put on a blacklist. It doesn't matter who you are or what kind of person you are. If you work two or three jobs, if you have a pocket full of money, nobody wants to bother with you. They don't care if you have children. They don't care if you're a good employee. If you're a good renter, they don't care.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's Kansas City woman Kaylee Ross looking back on her own experience with eviction. That's the topic of today's conversation on KCUR's Central Standard. Our guests are researcher Tara Ravugir, who worked on the book Evicted, and Brent Schondelmeyer of Link, the local investment commission. And this idea of being blacklisted by landlords seems like something that's come up again and again. Is there a way around that, Tara? I mean, as long as these are people in a private business, and we heard someone just say landlords who have been through eviction don't want to go through it again.
Yeah, I think the last caller identified one potential solution. I think there are some landlords who are committed to not investigating someone's record in terms of eviction, sort of starting fresh with each tenant that they bring in. And I think that's really honorable, but kind of an unrealistic expectation of landlords, especially in the terms that we've heard the landlord callers speak in. This is a business model for private landlords who are renting to tenants. So most of them want as much information on the tenant as they can get their hands on. And electronic records are making access to eviction data much easier for landlords, which kind of perpetuates the blacklist that Kaylee talks about. I think there are, you know, ways that that could be worked around. I think there are regulations that the city, the state, or the federal government could put on private landlords to ensure that they are renting to folks who have maybe faced this type of trouble in the past. But the blacklist is totally something that I heard a lot of tenants struggling with.
That seems like kind of an invisible side effect of eviction, something that you wouldn't just observe if you were physically standing there when this happened. I mean, are there other invisible side effects that families have to deal with long term once they've been evicted from a home?
I think so. I mean, the student mobility is a really interesting one that Brent and I have been talking about. That's something that you don't picture when you picture eviction. As you said earlier, Gina, you picture kind of items strewn across a lawn. You don't picture the trauma that a child goes through. I think another thing that I heard from several tenants in my interviews was that access to their healthcare providers was limited as a result of the sort of forced move that they would have to make in an eviction. Again, not something you typically understand as part of this process, but if someone goes to sort of a public healthcare provider in a certain neighborhood and then is forced to move far away from that provider, that can actually be really bad for them in terms of their health outcomes. And then, you know, not unrelated to that is proximity to their work. I think it was Kaylee who said that she had to quit her job when she was evicted because she was too far to travel to Grandview.
Once she was in a shelter.
Another really common, exactly. Another common phenomenon because, you know, if eviction is the cause of you quitting your job, again, you're trapped in this cycle, right? You need money to pay the rent, but you can't work because you're in a shelter. How do you possibly escape that?
Well, have you seen families escape that cycle somehow?
Yeah, I spoke to some tenants who had at least seemingly escaped the cycle of evictions. I didn't speak to anyone who I felt had escaped the cycle of poverty. Of course, there were other sort of implications to their being poor that continued to carry out in their lives. I think sometimes tenants ultimately find landlords who are more understanding. They find a situation that's somehow more affordable, puts them at less risk of falling behind on the rent. Sometimes the permanent solution was to move in with family members, and that was a form of stability.
So it sounds like the voluntary compassion of others is a big part of how people do get out of this cycle.
Yeah, whether landlords or family members, I think that was kind of the prevailing way that people got out of this cycle. But again, like I said, with 27 evictions happening per day in Kansas City, unfortunately, we can't rely on the voluntary compassion of others to be a solution to what is really an epidemic affecting our country.
Brent, I mean, you were sort of enthusiastically jotting down some notes as Tara was speaking, and I'm wondering, what are you thinking over there?
I'm just struck by the relatedness of what it is that we're sort of talking about. You can mischaracterize the conversations about the relationship between landlords and tenants, but in reality, it's much more complicated. Our community doesn't have a very strong public transportation system, so that limits your ability or access to jobs. There is a growing homicide rate in certain parts of our sort of community. That affects where it is that you might want to live. We have stagnant wages that have not risen in relationship to the cost of living, so that could be utility or housing or other sorts of things. Many people live on a fragile margin, and one little thing, a battery that doesn't work, can sort of put them into a tumbling into a complicated sort of world. If you need money and you may be able to borrow from your friends or your families, and that might work out okay, but many people will find themselves into a payday lending sort of situation. So we could probably sit here for hour on hour and explore different threads and strands about this all. What I find most important is that we start thinking about housing and just how significant it is really to the health and well-being of adults. In some senses, we probably have a stronger understanding about homelessness really around veterans because we've talked about it as a community. We've not necessarily had this level of conversation. To the landlords who called in, it's a complicated relationship. In some senses, have to be a friend and a partner and a caseworker for somebody who has a set of circumstances that might be more involved. But we haven't acknowledged is that in many cases, these are absentee landlords who live far, far away and in some senses can't be found and left to property management. So I hope the conversation continues. Note taking is a way for me to sort of take it in, and I've learned a lot today from your callers and also from Tara, whose research I greatly appreciate.
Well, Tara, I mean, what Brent is saying is he pointing to a unique set of circumstances in Kansas City, talking about public transportation and things like that, or are we kind of following a national trend in that, or part of a national trend? Is there anything about how our city works, our infrastructure, our climate, whatever, that makes eviction here different from what you see elsewhere?
Absolutely. I think it's both things. Kansas City is part of and following a national trend where affordable housing is limited and therefore evictions are becoming increasingly common. But I also think Kansas City is unique in that it is kind of a mid-sized rental market, a lot of renters out there, but a lot of landlords out there because the properties are not terribly unaffordable. So it becomes the second income stream for folks who otherwise, you know, have other business ventures going on.
And that landlords also might themselves not be wealthy.
Exactly. And that was certainly the case when I was studying in Kansas City. Another unique aspect of the city, which is much discussed in other issue areas, is, of course, that you have different jurisdictions, right? So evictions are adjudicated by county courts. And within the metro area, you have five different counties with different laws. And that impacts not only how the process goes, but also, for example, the tenants' understanding of their own rights. Tenants have very different rights in Kansas versus Missouri. And as a city that spans those state lines, it can be really, you know, difficult for a tenant to understand their rights. So like Brent, you know, I want to challenge the city. I don't know of a city that has a comprehensive plan to address evictions. I would love to see my hometown be that place. And let's see if we can reduce the number in the next 5 years.
Well, our time is up, but we're going to keep talking about how to pay the rent in Kansas City from a variety of perspectives. Send us an email or tweet if there's a rent-related issue that you would like us to discuss. Our email is centralstandard@kcur.org, and we're @KCURCST on Twitter. Tara Ravagir, thank you so much for sharing your research.
Thank you.
Tara is now Deputy Director of the Center for New Americans, an organization that works for immigrant and refugee rights. And Brent Schondelmeyer with us from Link here in Kansas City. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it, the conversation.
You can listen back to this show at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have it ready for you later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. And tomorrow, after a disappointing end to a great season for the Chiefs, we will talk about the history of major sports teams in Kansas City. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Ted Hope, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Caitlin Troutman. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.